Good morning, my name is Lexi, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
And I want to thank the committee, I want to thank Paul for giving me the privilege of coming to share this weekend at the convention. I want you to know that when I got my notice that I was coming to share with you, the last thing I expected was to be your closing speaker. Because I picture myself as being the kind of person who would share at a meeting at the beginning of a convention because you would be so damn grateful by the time you got to Sunday. Basically, it can only go up from there, right? But with that, some logistics, some information that is probably the most important thing that I'm going to share with you this morning, and that is that I have a sobriety date. I have the same sobriety date that I had originally. I'm one of those that is lucky enough to have not had to go out to this day of this year, so far. And that date is November 22nd, 1976. And I have a sponsor, and she wishes you well from Jacksonville, Florida, and her name is Polly Pistol. And I have a home group, and that is the Thursday Night Casablanca Into Action Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous in the lovely town of Riverside at the corner of Brockton and Harupa, 8 o'clock. Come early, get your seat. And I absolutely love my home group. You don't get from where I started my life to where I am today. You don't get to where my life began to where I am standing today before you, because there is a degree of gratitude and a degree of love and passion for Alcoholics Anonymous that I thought I would never have for this program, because I thought that what you had and what you represented when I was small was worlds apart from where I wanted to be. I thought you were boring. I thought that you just were a drag. I couldn't understand anybody that could possibly want to go a day without a drink. Because for me, when I started drinking, it was everything. It was my solution. It was the power that made life possible. It made it tolerable, because I felt like everything was very intolerable in my life. I felt sort of like there was sandpaper against my skin. And I felt like I was just going to crawl from the inside out most of my lifetime up until I found alcohol. I want you to know that I went to a meeting this last Wednesday night, and I was listening to this lovely lady who I've known for some time. She was talking in the meeting about when she first approached alcohol the first time. And this lovely lady is in her 60s, and she was raised in the 50s and the 60s, and had the idea that when she approached that age of 18, that she was going to be able to drink and become that grown-up, sophisticated woman that she thought she was meant to be. And I'm sitting in there in the meeting, and I'm listening to her share, and it occurs to me that I felt the exact same way that she was describing when I went and I had my first drink of alcohol for the effect. I wanted to be this mature, sophisticated, lovely, classic lady. The only condition that was different is that I was 11 years old. And that is when I had my first drink for effect. I was 11 years old at an auction in the lovely town of El Monte on a Friday night. What better way to start your drinking career than in the back of an auction where there's a bunch of horses and cows and all of this stuff. There was nothing sophisticated about the first night that I drank whatsoever. But that's how my career in drinking started. I believe, for me personally, that strange mental twist that is described in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous started long before I had my first drink. I felt inadequate, strange, and different as early as elementary school, kindergarten. Before that, there was always a strangeness and a uniqueness of how I felt and compared to those around me. and I could never quite get on the mark. And I knew that somewhere along the way, the rest of the people around me got instructions on how to do this life thing, and they just didn't get it to me, and I wasn't in the right line or whatever it is. But there was a strange, inadequate feeling that I could not get rid of. And it was everything. It was the fact that, you know, my dad was Hispanic and my mom was white, so I didn't quite fit in with the white girls and I didn't quite fit in with the Hispanic girls, and there was an inadequacy. And I knew that it was where we lived. You know, I was born in Burbank. I tell you that I was born at St. Joseph's Hospital across from Buena Vista Disney Studios, and it must have been because I was the biggest character that came along. And I thought that, you know, we would grow up and we would live in Los Angeles and that everything would be good. My mom and dad did not have a lot of money. In fact, I qualify us as upper-lower class, I guess is the best way to put it. But they had some good ideals. I truly believe that today. They were Goldwater Republicans. Politics was an everyday conversation at our dinner table, and there was a lot of conflict with that. My brother had the audacity to become a McGovern Democrat, and I thought that he was going to die behind that choice. There was a lot of anger on my dad's part, and a lot of yelling, a lot of screaming. And on the same page is this lovely woman, my mother, who in the process of her adult life had come across alcohol, and it became her solution. And my mom would be what would be described in the big book as a periodic. She would go maybe days, weeks, maybe even months without a drink. But then somewhere along the way, maybe mom and dad would have a fight in the morning, or there would be something else that would happen. And I knew that by that evening, my mom would be under the influence of alcohol. And she would go do strange, unique things that the woman that I knew as my mom would never have done in her lifetime once she started drinking alcohol. And it would just go downhill from there. And things got really, really rough and really, really hostile in our home. I am one of four children. I was an accident. Literally. My mom and dad, somewhere along the way on one particular evening after a dinner at the local Elks Lodge, decided they liked each other briefly, and I'm a result of a martini evening. They did not like each other much. My mom and dad looked like Boris and Natasha from Bullwinkle. My mom was just shy of 6 foot. She was a stunning, lanky, very tall, very elegant looking woman. My dad was 5'9". He had a flat top, dark brimmed glasses, Popeye arms, and crooked teeth. And he was a very angry individual. And the contrast was really interesting. And I remember that when I was young, I used to describe them to my friends as being entirely different than what they were. So obviously nobody could come home to our house. Because my perception was nothing like what I lived with. But needless to say, along the way, I had decided that that first drink of alcohol was going to change everything. We ended up moving to the thriving metropolis of La Puente when I was about 4 years old. And I grew up in an area called Valinda Flats. And this was not high class by any means. And I knew that the differences were everything. The differences were the color of my hair. The differences were the color of my eyes. It had to do with the fact that there were no sidewalks in front of our houses. The fact that we lived in Valinda instead of West Covina. If we only lived 2 miles away from where we lived, everything would be different. And if my mom and dad looked different than they did, everything was a matter of a change, just a change, just a few steps away from where I was, and it would all be good. Needless to say, I want you to know that I did not have a long drinking career. I drank for a total of 4 years. But just like you've heard before, there was a desperateness that came with my drinking, and I drank as much as I could, as often as I could. And for me, it was a lot of work. Because of my age, it was required that I steal alcohol. Because how do you get alcohol at 11, 12, 13, 14 years old without having to manipulate, lie, and cheat and do it? And I hung out with girls that did things exactly the way I did. And I liked the excitement and the adrenaline that came with the anticipation of the next drink. Because it really was a matter of taking a deep breath and exhaling for me. Because I knew once I got enough in me that it wouldn't matter what street we lived on, what I looked like, what you thought of me, or anything else. And that was my primary purpose to drink, is to turn off the care button, to turn it off so that I didn't have to think about it anymore. And I personally, I was born in 1961. My primary years of excitement are during the 70s, early 70s. I listened to groups like Bad Company, Foghat, Indigata Davida by Iron, or what is it, Iron Butterfly. That kind of stuff is what I was raised with. And then my big sister was a Motown freak, and the Four Tops and the Temptations and all that was the music that was in our home. And I started hanging out with some exciting people. And I ended up going to a school in West Covina called Edgewood High School. And the girls I hung out with dressed and acted like what I wanted. My uniform for getting loaded, I love describing it because it's so classic now. There's a lot of people fighting to get the clothes that I wore then now. It's really interesting. But I would wear bell-bottom hip-hugger jeans, and I had T-shirts with Colombian written across the front, and leather things around my neck with big wooden beads because I was very much in the style then, and there was a medicinal roach clip at the end of the leather, and I had very long hair. In fact, when I met Dean's wife, Debbie, this is what I looked like. Very long hair, and my favorite word was bitchin'. And I thought I was very cool, but the truth is I was this little obnoxious female that was obstinate about life, and when you said two is four, I would say, no, it's got to be five, because it's just how my attitude was, and I trusted nothing that you said to me. And so when I drank, I didn't care what you said to me anymore. In fact, I really didn't care what I said to you. And my mouth got me in a world of hurt and a lot of trouble because I would be obnoxious, hostile, and angry. And I had a chip on my shoulder. And there were plenty of obstacles and things that I went through as a direct result of my thinking, not even my drinking. It was my thinking. And needless to say, at the age of 15, I had gotten to the point where I had my room set up because I was paranoid. I don't know why, but I was paranoid. And I set up my bed in my room to where I could keep an eye on the window and the closet and the door because I knew someone was going to come in and get me. And I was scared to death all the time, just frightened of life. And I had gone to Catholic school, and I remember I really earnestly wanted a relationship with God, but I didn't know how to get there. And I remember I would sit in Mass, and they would make us go before, if we happened to show up at school before school started, you would be forced to go in and go for morning Mass. And I remember I would sit there, and I would watch these people around me. I would watch the priests, and I would watch the nuns, and I would see their reaction to what was being said and to that cross up on the wall. And they looked like it was a place of comfort. And I couldn't get there. And I thought, how can you possibly have that relationship? I knew definitely for me that belief system, that belief in that higher power was definitely not for me. Because if that God truly cared about me and all those prayers that I used to try to say when I was young, if that God truly cared about me, if I was worth being cared about, then the things that happened in my home and to me personally would never have transpired. And there was such an anger inside of me because I knew that God did not love me. I knew it beyond a shadow of a doubt. Because there were some other things that happened along the way, and I don't go into great detail in a mixed meeting, but I will tell you that before I started drinking alcohol, I fell in love with my first love. It'll probably be my first love until the day I die. There was an old man that moved next door, and he had quarter horses. And for the first time in my life, I found something that I could do, and I could ride like the wind. And I absolutely loved the way I felt when I was on top of that animal doing my thing. But along with that, there was a tremendous price tag. And at the age of 7, 8 years old, I lost the spirit of a young lady that should be able to experience all the innocence and all the things that happen along the way, such as proms and your first date and your first kiss and all of those things. And that left for me at the age of 7 or 8 years old. And that abuse was to take place for the next 4 years of my life. And that, too, was a very good reason to drink and a very good reason to be angry at God, because why would that stuff happen to me? Why would that have to happen? And I want to tell you the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is essential, is that anything, I believe anything is possible to get through and to grow through and to be able to use as an asset in recovery. If we do the steps, if we do them painstakingly, if we do them as they are described in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because those feelings, that relationship with God, the things that transpired in my home, the things that transpired over at that ranch across the street, have been able to become the best attributes in my life because I have been able to turn around and I have been able to share with other women who are new in the program that there is hope and recovery if you stick around here and you earnestly want it more than anything else. And over my recovery, that in fact is what has happened for me, is that I have gotten to that point in my life where being sober, being in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and working on that relationship with a higher power is like breathing in and out for me anymore, because I know in my heart of hearts that if I don't continue to do that, the breathing in and out will cease, because I can't stand living in my skin without this program. I can't stand living with the kind of thoughts that I come up with and the kind of shenanigans and the plans and all of that stuff that I do without your direction and your guidance, because it gets nasty really, really quick, and there is an accountability that I give up for my life because I want to point the finger at all of you and say, but you just don't understand me. I'm misunderstood, and I'm a victim of circumstance, and if you better took care of me, then I wouldn't feel the way I do. And the truth is that the blessing of recovery is that it has given me the opportunity to act like an adult that I am incapable of doing of my own without your direction. I ended up meeting our first speaker's wife. She was pretty damn hip-slick and cool. I want you to know she was. Now she's a school teacher. I don't get it. I met her in the recovery house I was to end up at. Now, back in the 70s, and boy, I'm going to sound like an old coger, but the truth is, back in the 70s, recovery houses were run a little bit different than they are today. I want you to know that they had no interest in where I came from or what I did. They were not going to coddle me into recovery. Basically, what I was told is exactly what it says. If you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. And in the case of this particular house, they meant every word of that. Because if, in fact, you didn't want it, they wouldn't even help you pack your bags. They would just say, there's the door, make yourself at home wherever you end up, and maybe if you stay alive, we'll see you down the road. And they were just about that blunt. And for this alcoholic, that's exactly what I needed. I am a manipulator, a con, a cheat, and a liar at the very core of my disease. And if I can con you into feeling sympathy for me, I will do that. And I can tell you that Sam Hardy that ran that house, and God love him, he died in recovery, used to put it best when he would tell me that sympathy is between shit and syphilis in the dictionary. And it's worth about that much. Worth about that much. And because of that, the people that I was around, the people that I was with in that recovery house, got to show me several things about recovery and also what is left for me out there if I choose to pick up another drink. And I had plenty of examples of what I had, what I could have if I chose to drink again. And there is something inside of me, despite my best plans and designs, that kept telling me, you will die if you drink again. And that has not left me. There have been times, and I will be honest with you, when I have found it absolutely necessary to drink alcohol in sobriety. There has been times when the pain has been so excruciating that I have felt like that would have been the right answer. And again, the thing that comes to my mind is that normal people don't think that way. And second of all, thank you, God, for that thought. Thank you, God, for that feeling, because once again, it validates the reason why I am different than my fellows. Because I don't see normal people, and I work out in the public, and I work with people that go out and do a very hard job, let me tell you. I don't see them saying, God, you know, today's been rough. If I just took the edge off a little bit. And I'm not saying I don't work with some that probably feel that way, but the ones that amaze me are the ones that get up every day, go to work, perform, and they don't want to use, but I'm an alcoholic, as a reason for anybody to applaud them and feel like, God, we're really glad you're here. These people get up and do their life every day without that excuse, without that justification. And for me, that's exactly what I end up going back to. It's a justification and a rationalization that makes it okay for me to drink. And that, I'm glad I haven't lost touch with. But needless to say, I went into that house and I met the young lady that is my friend to this day, and 21 other young alcoholics between the ages of 13 and 20. And they're all in this house, and they're trying to provide themselves with a way of living that they didn't come in there with. Let me tell you, they did not come in there with it. And I was to get a hard dose of what recovery's about real quick. And these people, as much as they loved us, the staff at this particular house came from places that we had yet to travel. And they were definitely waiting for us. And as a result of what Ann and Sam gave us, I had a very, very good foundation for the first 7 months of my recovery in the fact that this is how it works. And there wasn't a lot of extra stuff. It was just basically Alcoholics Anonymous in this home. And I left there with a lot of head knowledge. I want you to know I left there with a lot of head knowledge. But getting it to my gut has what's taken the rest of the recovery all the way up and including the very morning that I'm standing here before you, because it has been a process. Now, some of the things I want to share with you, first of all, I want to share something that was told to me a year ago last May by one of the most wonderful men I've ever known. And ironically, he's not an alcoholic. He's been a member of Al-Anon for 47 years, and his name is Bob Lahan. And the only reason why I break his anonymity is because he does it himself. And he happened to be married to the woman who sponsored me for 30 years of my recovery. And the day after my sponsor died, I was sitting in their living room with Bob, and he said something essentially, probably one of the most important things I think I've ever heard in my recovery. He made a comparison of Alcoholics Anonymous to the 12-step program of that with the history of inheritance. And he said, history shows us that usually it's the third generation that squanders away their inheritance. And he looked me dead in the eye and he said, Lexi, he goes, you are the third generation of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he asked me very, very firmly, he says, what are you going to do with that? How are you going to go out from here and be able to continue on with what was so freely given to you? And I can tell you for the 30 years that I had his wife Goldina as my sponsor, there wasn't a day or a conversation or a time that I spent with her when she wasn't a firm example of recovery as it should be. She was involved in service. She was married to the same man for 66 years of her life. You know, she was lucky enough to live next door to this guy named Frank Honeycutt down at the beach, and he is the one that 12-stepped her. And she is the one that got involved in service, stayed sober, and was able to pass on to me the way she did it. And I can tell you that I wanted the things she had in her life. Now, some important things that I want you to know right now, and I love sharing this. I am not, and this is one of the reasons why, my gosh, spiritual meeting, closing speaker, are you kidding me? I'm really, really questioning Paul's delusions of what the example is for a Sunday morning speaker. But anyway, and I love you, Paul, I do. I absolutely love you to death. My point being is that I'm going to tell you what not to do. I'm going to tell you what not to do if you want this thing called recovery, because I'm an example that despite my better plans, you can stay sober. And there's a few things really, really important for me to point out. And I love sharing these things because they're probably the most important. And I say this a lot. Sponsorship's as good as the information you share with your sponsor. Absolutely as good as what you share with that man or that woman is exactly what you're going to get out of your recovery. Because I am one of those that loved the idea of, oh, by the way, there were a lot of conversations with Goldine that would start off with, oh, by the way, and then I would tell her what I had already done. Getting married. Moving. New job, old job, no job, go to a meeting, not go to a meeting, meet him on AA campus, or better yet, how about a wrecking yard? Met him in a wrecking yard. That was a great one. And I want you to know he was very, very happy. He was constantly happy, and he called me Angel, and I was about 7 years sober, and he looked like Sal Mineo, and he smiled all the time, and he was so sweet. And it wasn't until 2 years later that I found out that when I met him, he was very, very happy because he was on LSD the whole time. If they're rough and ready and a little edgy, I'm in, because I like the excitement. And, you know, I was sharing with a girl that I want you to know this weekend has been exactly the perfect formula for me, because I have been able to bring a newcomer with me, folks. I got to bring a newcomer to this convention, and I am one of those people. I remember hearing Ann Hardy talk about this, and I really couldn't grasp it at the time because I was young and very self-centered, but now I know what she's talking about. There is nothing that will charge me more than taking a newcomer and putting them flat dab in the middle of you and just watching you do your magic, watching you take them by the hand, put them in a meeting, and just look at them. You know, there's something about it. I know you'll understand. I was watching, God, I love Mary, and I was watching her when I told her, check it out, she's got one day. And Mary got this excitement on her face like, yeah, that's good, that's good. While this young gal is sitting next to me going, no, it feels really bad. It feels feels really, really bad, you know? And I'm watching all of that stuff happen, and I'm remembering back what I've experienced over the years and the beauty of recovery, despite me, and what it's given me, the gifts it's given me. And the thing is that here I have this newcomer with me, and you just wish, beyond wish, that you could, like, take an IV. Here we go with the alcoholic in me. Take an IV from Alcoholics Anonymous and pump it in her arm and say, okay, fill it up. Just give it to her. Give it all to her. And the thing is that we don't get it without the work. You know, there's no way that I can keep anybody else sober. I can tell you there were days when those phone calls to Goldine, when I would be telling her some new shenanigans I came up with, and I know she was on the other end of the phone, and the gray hairs were just slowly popping out of her head, because I was, oh, man. I've had to sponsor women like me since then, and it's not, God, it's not fun. I remember the first time. I think it's the most joy I've ever heard in Goldine's voice when I called her to complain about this gal I was sponsoring. She won't follow my direction, and she's like, really? Yeah. Really. She's not listening to you. My gosh, you know? And then we do the same thing I think we do with our parents when we grow up and we find out that life's a little tougher than we thought it was. And I would call Goldine and I would earnestly thank her and I would also apologize for every bit of agony I ever put her through. And she would just say, "It's okay, honey, I love you. You know, when's your next meeting?" You know, the little things that she's done over the years that I am just lucky enough to have as part of what I call my file cabinet of things of Alcoholics Anonymous and go through the file cabinet and pull out a card with something new that I get to share with someone. And, you know, some of the things that she has taught me that I get to share with you this morning are that God is in this instance. And I couldn't get that for a long time. You know, when I would talk to her about these broken dreams and these ideals that I had come up with, and she would once again say over and over again, "Where's God in that plan, Lexi? Where's your God? Because if it's of you, it's not going to work." And there were plenty of times when I really didn't want to hear that. And I would be defiant, and I'd go ahead and have to push it a little further, find out a little bit more of how it wasn't working. And I would go back to her with arrows in my butt. And she'd sort of turn me around and look, say, "Yeah, man, there's a lot of arrows there. How's it feeling?" And I did this stuff without a drink, and I don't know how. I really don't know how. But needless to say, you know, in that relationship with her, she taught me about God being in the instant, that God is in this moment now. And I picked up this design, and it seemed to work. It works to this very day, and I use it when I am not able to communicate with my sponsor, Polly, and I'm going to tell you how that relationship transpired here in a second. But I remember the feeling. I remember the discomfort that I would have and that hollowness. You know, Sam Hardy at Turnoff used to call it the God hole. And what we do in our alcoholic behavior is that we come up with so many ways to try to fill that God hole up. And it didn't matter whether it was alcohol, other things that affected me from the neck up, whether it was a man, whether it was a new job, a new place to live, whatever else. I would try to fill that God hole and I would miss the whole point of what recovery is about. And Golding would talk about God being this instance. And I thought, God, that is so trite. But she lived it. And so I don't know where along the way, but it became necessary for me to really listen, to digest what she was telling me. And I came up with this little act that I would do. You know, something like people who put rubber bands around their wrists when they're trying to maybe get off of cigarettes or remember something they've gotten. They'll tap at that rubber band to remind themselves. Well, I came up with an analogy that really worked for me, and I practice it to this day. And that is when I'm starting to feel that little girl in the alley, dark alley, feeling like I'm alone and separate, what I do is I snap my finger and I tell myself, God is right there, right in that instant. And for some reason, it brings me right back down to today, where I need to be, which is the right size to fit in with you. And then the other thing I do, and I am very lucky this weekend, because God put this newcomer in my life. Let me tell you, she put her in my home. I am with her. Why is that happening for me? And there's a thing inside that goes, "Oh my God, they're so freaking needy. Man." And then you see the lights go on. And you see them go through that thing of getting excited about the meeting. And you see them listening to the speaker and they're hearing the very, very thing they need to make it. And there is something that I can't even begin to tell you. But you hear it all the time. And if you're new or maybe you're not new and you're in a place where you're not feeling that magic right now, I'm going to tell you what Polly says. Don't leave 5 seconds before the miracle. Don't leave before that miracle happens, because it's right here. And I truly believe that. A few things I want you to know. You know, that sponsor that died a year ago last May, I got to be there. I want you to know why and how I got to be there. And it started back in the year 2000 when my mom was diagnosed for the second time with cancer. And I was very, very self-consumed at that time. And I did not want to have to feel any of what she was going through. So what I did was, for the last 3 months of her life, I became an absentee daughter. And it was totally self-centered. I did not want to get close to her, and I didn't want to be a part of what was going on with her, because I knew that if I was, I was going to break down. And I was going to be less than what I wanted to be, as this tough exterior type woman that could handle anything. And I sure didn't want to tell Goldine or my mom or anybody else that I just couldn't handle it. And I was in a very bad place in my recovery. So needless to say, I ran a lot. I was busy. I work in a career in law enforcement. Don't you know I'm on shift work? I have stuff. I've got people murdering each other. That's important, right? And here I am, not being accountable to the very woman that gave birth to me. And so she gets down to the last week of her life, the last week of her life. And I am in my house, and ironically, it's October 17th, which happens to be my belly button birthday. And of all people, my ex-husband shows up, and he's sitting at my kitchen table, and the phone rings, and it's my mom. And she's calling me and asking me to come over to her house because she wants to give me a birthday gift. Now, can you imagine how I'm feeling inside my gut at that very moment? Last thing in the world I want to do is go over and be accountable to my actions in front of this woman who is literally dying. And my ex-husband turns to me across the table, and Russell looks me dead in the eye, and he says, "If you do not go over and do what you need to in this relationship, you are going to regret it the rest of your days." And for some reason, what he was saying echoed in my gut, and I knew that he was absolutely right. So he held my hand, and we drove over to my mom's house, and here I am, this stunning example of recovery. It was such a crock. And we go into my mom's house, and I am scared to death of her at that very moment, because I have to talk to her, and I'm afraid to talk to her. And she's sitting in her chair in the living room. And my mom, I want you to know, she had 28 years of recovery when she died. She had 28 years of sobriety when she died. She's the one that introduced me to my heroes like Norm Alpe. Her first sponsor was Flo D. There were people that came to speak at her meeting like John Newton and other people that I have had the privilege of hearing over the years that I would not have known if it wasn't for my mom. I want you to know that she is the one that planted the seed of recovery in my life. And I kicked, fought, and screamed the whole way, because don't you know, if you were old and used up like her, you'd have a reason to get sober. But I didn't have her problems. That same woman sits in this chair next to me in this living room, and I'm sitting there. And all of a sudden, I realize that I might be able to do this on my own. So I tell my ex-husband, "Can you please go get me a pack of gum?" And I sit there and I pray. And then I turn to my mom and I tell her the things that everything in me, I don't want to get out. I don't want to say them. And I turn to her and I say, "I'm going to miss you." And I didn't want to say that, because I thought, how self-consumed is that statement? And I told her that I didn't want to be a disappointment to her as her daughter. And my mom, 5 days away from taking her last breath, turns to me and uses the program in the last conversation we're to have. She says, "Honey, it's life on life's terms." And then I got up out of that. I don't know why this is so emotional today, but it is. Maybe one of you need to hear this. I don't know. Or maybe I just need to remember it. I get up off of that couch, and for the first time in 3 months, I ask my mom if I can hug her. And she gives me one of those big, huge hugs that only that woman knew how to give. And that sense of relief comes over me. So let's go forward to May of last year. And my sponsor is getting ready to take, thank you, my sponsor, Freudian slip, she was like my mom. She's preparing for her next journey too. And that's exactly what I believe it is today. And I am at her house, and I'm accountable, because I realize on this trip around that I have to be, that I have to be that woman of Alcoholics Anonymous that she and other women and men in this room have taught me how to be. And it's only because of what you have that I'm standing here. And I was able to be there, and I was able to hold her husband's hand and talk to her son and talk to her daughter and watch them go through the very same thing that I knew was a matter of a next journey. And I'm so glad that I am able to stand up here tonight or today and tell you that I didn't miss it. I didn't miss it. I didn't go on one of those self-will trips where I disappear, become missing in action. Because don't you know, I'm busy in my life, and I just don't got time. And I felt alone and scared. I felt very alone and scared when Goldine left. But there was a legacy of Alcoholics Anonymous that she put in my gut. And I can tell you that since she has left, almost on a daily basis, little things will happen, and I can hear her in my head telling me the things that she told me when she was still here. And I'm thinking, how does somebody do this? And I had some wonderful people that came before me in recovery that have shown me how to survive the loss of a sponsor. And they've done a really, really good job. And I prayed a lot. I want you to know I prayed a lot. I had talked to Polly briefly about sponsorship a few months before. But I remember when I finally had the first conversation, serious conversation with her about sponsorship after Goldine had passed, that I was able to tell with her that I felt so guilty about even talking to her about sponsorship before Goldine was gone, because I felt like I was being disloyal to this woman. And she told me in her southern little Texas drawl, she says, "Honey, I understand totally." And at first she felt a little awkward about accepting me as her baby, because the truth is, I got 6 months more sobriety than she does. But it doesn't matter, because she's got what I want. And that's really all that's important here. And that's what I told her in that conversation. But let me tell you about God and his divine wisdom in my life, because this is what happened. I didn't get to talk to Polly right away. It was about a month and a half. In fact, it was a year ago last month. And this is what happened, and I believe in God's divine intervention. I believe that he sets everything as it should be. Not the way Lexi thinks it should be, but as he thinks it should be. Because I had gone to a morning meeting. There is a group of people that get together every morning up in the high desert in Apple Valley. And I want you to know, first of all, you need to know this. Apple Valley, there is not one damn apple in that town. No. Jeez, there's a lot of road apples, there's a lot of horses, there's cactus, there's tumbleweed, there's creosote bushes, not one damn apple in the whole place. And I don't know why, it's just a bad joke. Needless to say, I'm sitting in that morning meeting at the local Valley Alano Club in Apple Valley. 7 a.m. meeting, a lot of good people go to that meeting, and we get out the daily reflections, and we're reading the particular page, and it's talking about taking the goggles off and being aware of what's around you, that you will remain open. And I had a girl, Tracy, that I absolutely love, that I sponsored this with me that particular morning, and I'm sharing in the meeting, and I'm saying, you know, it's been a month and a half since my sponsor has died, and I'm really not sure what direction I'm supposed to go in, but I'm a little bit scared, because I know that I need some direction. I need somebody in my life. I need to continue exactly what Bob had told me about that legacy. That means that I continue to do the things that keep me sober, which means I need a sponsor. And this is exactly what happened, in exactly the time element. We get done with that meeting. I've had that conversation. I've shared in that meeting. We get in my car. We go to drive away from the meeting, and I have that Bluetooth device. I used to call it Bluefish. I'm so technologically challenged. I have Bluetooth in my car. And out of the blue, the phone rings. We are not 10 minutes away from that meeting. And I answer that phone. And I hear this little Texas drawl. "Hi, honey, this is Polly. And I don't know why, but I've had you on my mind all morning." And I tell her I know why. And I asked her to be my sponsor. because I knew I needed that direction. I need that to stay with you. I need that to be able to keep the sobriety that I have been freely given. You know, if you're in here this morning and it happens to be because a judge has told you that you need us, I'm not going to tell you whether you do or not. If you're here today because your spouse has told you, you better clean up your act or you're going to lose your marriage, or if it's a matter of that career or anything else that has brought you to Alcoholics Anonymous, I am not going to tell you to stay. I'm going to tell you to go out and get flipping busy if you are not done, because until you are done, this will not take. On the other hand, I will also tell you that from here on out, if this happens to be your first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you are screwed. Pretty much. Because here on out, we're going to be in the back of your head. We're going to be there telling you, there's a better way. And your drinking is going to be a lot of drag. A lot of drag. But I know that for me, this is the ticket. You know, and I've heard it said, and I am a contradiction of terms here too. I've heard it said, it's the last house on the block. It is the best house on the block, folks. Because without this, I have nothing. Without this, I think about killing the wrong person. Without this, I am incapable of being a parent. I'm incapable of being the kind of employee that you guys have taught me how to be. I am definitely not capable of sponsoring anybody or giving anything of worth to anyone around me, because my head tells me that I am worthless. My alcoholic head tells me that the rest of you have the answers to that book and that I didn't get them. You know, that stuff happens to me all the time. A few quick things that are very, very important. Along the way in recovery, I had the opportunity to get into the career that I am in today. And I don't know why God thought this was so funny. Sometimes I think God does stuff just for his personal entertainment. I had gone to a symposium for Intergroup, and I was with, my second child was about 2 months old. I have two girls. Both of them have been born in recovery, thank God. And she was 2 months old, and I needed to get a job. Because once again, I had come across and I had discovered, found, fallen for in heat, I don't know what. But my second child's dad is also one of us and not in recovery. And that second child was 2 months old, and I needed a job. And I had my shopping cart with me, and I did this very thing that you guys have taught me how to do. I need to get in action. And I went into the local Alpha Beta, and I had on a pair of shorts and a t-shirt, and I'm sure I wasn't looking real pretty. And I had the four-year-old and the two-month-old infant in the shopping cart, and I went up to the cashier and I said, I need some work. And I guess I had the look in my eye of, I'm not going to take no for an answer. And she said, well, our manager is in that door over there by the butcher area. So I take my shopping cart, and I think, I can't leave my kids outside. So I take the shopping cart and pull it right through the door into this office. And here's this gal sitting behind this desk, and she's looking at her paperwork, and she looks up. I says, I need a job. She didn't even question. She says, you're hired. She had me fill out the application afterwards. And I'm going to tell you, I worked my little butt off. Here I am. I'm 28 years old. I'm sober. I'm doing the things that you've told me to do. And I'm taking care of shopping carts in that parking lot out front. And I'm not pushing in four or five. I got something to prove. I'm pushing in 15 and 20 of those babies. And there's people looking at me saying, you know, you really don't have to do that much. In the back of my head, I said, you don't understand. I'm an alcoholic. I need to do this much. Because that's the standard that I have to set to be just as good as you, you know? That's just how I am. And I've got that job, and I've had it for about 3-4 weeks, and my fingers and my knuckles are just sore as they could be from that. I'm telling you, I've been a laborer at a cement plant, and I have been a box girl at Alpha Beta, and that is a hard flipping job. It is a hard job. It takes its toll on you. And I'm doing it every day. So this particular weekend, my mom had talked to one of the girls she sponsored and mentioned that I was looking for employment. So I'm at the intergroup symposium, and this gal approaches me, and she says, you know, my work is looking for somebody, and, you know, you might be interested. And she's sort of subtle about it. I almost get the impression that she was probably thinking, why I'm approaching you about this, I don't have any idea. But she went ahead and explained to me that it was a pretty stressful job, but that it was a pretty decent one, and that I might like it. And I feel like she's going around the thing, you know, well, what is it? And I'm like, what is it? And then she tells me that they're hiring a dispatcher at the police department she works for. Now, mind you, the closest I came to anybody in a uniform was hiding in bushes in strange people's garages. I did not like black and whites. I didn't like authority. I didn't like cops, and I sure as heck knew for sure that they didn't like me. And I looked at her, and I laughed, and I said, I don't see them hiring me. I don't see them picking me up and putting me in charge of telling cops where to go. I just didn't see that. And she says, just come and fill out an application. So I followed through, and I went through the whole process. And any of you who have worked in any type of public setting like this will understand why this was pretty gutsy of me. I will never forget my interview with the chief of police for that particular department when he turned to me and he said, could you tell us something about yourself? Oh, I think about this to this day, and I know people that have worked in public service, because what I'm about to tell you, any of you who do, or you're going to get what I'm talking about. I had the audacity to look at this man, and in my cockiness, I said, well, what do you want to know, my blood type? And he fell in love with me. He said it was one of the best interviews he had ever had. I don't know if he meant it was the most entertaining, but to this day, I think about having said that to that man, I think, God, you are just amazing that you said that to him. And then they give me this polygraph. I got to go down and do a polygraph. You can imagine. They hook me up to these wires and these things, and this guy's asking me questions because I've filled out everything exactly the way you told me. I have been absolutely honest about who and what I am. And I fill that out, and I sit across the table from this guy. And he's got that little machine going, and the little wire is hitting everything. And I'm sitting there, and I'm like, shh, I got nothing to lose. And he asked me about my drinking, because I put down that I, you know, yeah, I drank. And he said, well, tell me a little about that. So I gave him the spiel of, you know, well, I haven't drank at that time. I think it was 14 years. I don't even know. And he looks at me, and he goes, he goes, in the last year, have you had a drink of alcohol? I said, no, I haven't had a drink of alcohol. And then he got down to the chemical part, which there isn't a lot. There isn't a lot. I am a pothead, folks. I did not do anything else, but boy, I did that to the, oh, my God, I lived for that stuff. It was so great. And he had the nerve to ask me, how many times? And I looked at him dead in the eye, and I said, a lot? A lot. I can't begin to tell you how many times. Oh, my gosh. So I say, how many times have you taken a swig off a whiskey bottle? Are you kidding me? Could you even imagine somebody asking you that question? I can't fathom. So you know what he did? He got out a piece of paper and a pencil, and he goes, okay, how many times per day? He wrote that down. How many days per week? He wrote that down. How many times per month? And we added it up, and we gave an approximate number, and that's what I gave. And I thought, for sure, there's no way. I'm not going to pass this thing now, because I wasn't going with what you guys have taught me. It's not a matter of judgment. It's a matter of the truth. And that's all he wanted from me, was the truth. So he got it, folks. He got the truth. And I got hired on at that police department. And on August 2nd, I have been with the same department for 15 years. And on October 16th, it will be 23 years in this same career. And I tell cops where to go every day. And I love it. I love it. There's a responsibility and an accountability to the career that I have. And I am capable of doing it because you have taught me how. This is going to sound really strange to maybe some of you, but the reason why I'm good at what I do is because I did my steps. The reason why I'm good at what I do is because you taught me to be accountable for my side of the street. You taught me how to look at that fourth column in my fourth step and get real about what I brought to the table and what my motivations were, what I was willing to lie about, cheat about, all of that. You taught me how to do that. And in recovery, I've had to do it again and again and again. Because guess what? Life didn't stop at 15 for me. I had puberty going for me, folks. I had a lot more than just getting off the alcohol and the drugs. I had a situation where I had to learn how to grow up. And it's been a long process. I want to tell you, at 50 years old, I think I'm on the right path. Because I'm still immature inside. And I still have this kid that really wants you to take accountability for my life. And the thing is that God blesses me with these women that just refuse to do that. Because I think they know that that would be the gateway for me to die. So what I've done, and I want to tell you a little about this week, in the situation with this newcomer. I'm an arrogant alcoholic. And there have been times in recovery when the last thing I have wanted to do was to get in my car and go have some chick, sweat it out, puke, whatever else, because I've got better things to do with my time. And then there's this little nudge on my, this little tap reminding me, you will not keep what you've got unless you give it away. And Ann Hardy in that house used to talk about the fact that she loved a wet, miserable drunk. She loved women that just had that desperateness. And she would get those beaming brown Betty Boop eyes of hers, and they would just get higher than a kite on the idea of some wet, desperate female drunk that wanted this thing more than breathing. And I know what that's like now. I've had that happen a few times. But there's just enough Al-Anon in me to know what to do. And that is no, I'm not in a position where I'm going to rescue you from your disease. I'm going to offer you the solution, and then it's your choice. But what I've done this week is exactly what you guys did with me. And if there's any question in your mind of what 12-stepping has to do with, let me tell you what I was taught. And that is, get in my back pocket and go do what I do. Go to the meetings I go to. Meet the wonderful women. I was excited this weekend because I knew, you know, it's not about Paul asking me to speak this morning. I believe I'm here this morning because I was supposed to bring that newcomer to you guys. That's why I'm here this morning. It has nothing to do with me. It has to do with giving me the perfect forum to be able to give the message to somebody else and then watch them make the choice whether or not it's what they want. And for me, to give them the dignity to make that choice. Let them have that. Let them have the dignity to figure out whether this is the solution for them or not, because it may not be a fit. And I am the last one to sit here and judge whether or not that's going to be a match for them. But I know this, that when I sat there yesterday and I'm watching this newcomer listen to you, she got to sit in that old-timer meeting yesterday and listen to one of my heroes. I love you, Jim. And look at his beautiful wife. And these are examples of what I want in my life. And watch the lights go on. Watch her react to what this man had to share. And then yesterday, of all things, I was hemming and hawing. Do I really want to go to that Al-Anon luncheon or not? And I heard this young man yesterday named Bryson. And I'm telling you what, that dude is a black belt Al-Anon. And I loved every word that came out of his mouth. And I was hooked in. I was hooked into what he was sharing, and it was the best thing possible for me. And that newcomer enjoyed it too. And then last night, Larry shared. And he made us cry and he made us laugh. And we were crying at the things that were beautiful and we were laughing at the things that were hideous. And I love that wonderful contrast in recovery. I hope beyond hope that if this is your first convention, you come back and join us. I will warn you that they are very addictive. There's something about getting to a convention, and then you get your program, and you're looking through it, and you're just like, and I want to be here, and I want to do this, and this is going to happen, and then I'm going to talk to them, and you know? And by the time you leave here on Sunday, you're so damn exhausted. Between the meetings and talking to people at coffee, and boy, do we drink coffee at conventions. Holy cow. I think you have to detox when you leave an AA convention. And it's all that stuff, and I'm watching it go on this weekend, and I'm watching these people, and I'm watching them get lit up on recovery. And then they get to go home and they get to say, God, I heard the speaker and I went here and I did this. And I tell you, there's nothing like it in the world. So I know that my reason for being here this morning is because Paul was that little angel that made it possible for me to bring that newcomer to you and introduce her to you. You know, our speaker before me, Dean, a little offshoot that has everything to do with recovery, is that at that wedding on July 4th, 6 years ago, I got to stand up next to my girlfriend, Debbie, and watch her marry this beautiful man that's sitting at this table with me. And I can tell you that we're both still here, and that is beyond any odds that have to do with this disease, because it kills people like us. My thinking, my alcoholic thinking, kills me and kills those around me. And I know that it's only a matter of inches and seconds between me and that first drink. And you will help make that possible for me not to have to take that drink today. And that's really what it's about. So as you go out from here this morning, what I would ask you to do is remember that we are the third generation of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what are you going to do with it, folks? What are you going to do when you leave here? Go get in that 12 and 12 study. Go to that big book study. Take another look at that book that maybe's been sitting there with a little bit of dust on it, because I've been guilty of that. And get turned on to Alcoholics Anonymous again. Open up that book and read that fifth chapter and find out, oh my gosh, that gremlin got in there and rewrote my book. Because that happens to me all the time. I get turned on with the fascination of what I find that has been in that print. I know it's probably been there, but for some reason the light bulb goes on differently and I catch something that I didn't get last time I read it. And then I get to turn it on to the girls I sponsor and say, check this out, look at what I found. And they look at me like I am nuts, because they know, well, wasn't that written like 1939? Yeah, but it's new to me, you know? And then I get to share it with them. And I dig on that. Fall in love with recovery if you are new. Fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. Make this the middle of your world. And like one of my favorite stories in the big book talks about, there's a story in the back, and I love the title, you know, Bridge of Denial. And this chick talks about the formula for her recovery. She talks about what she does on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, to be able to stay in the middle of us. And I absolutely love it, because it's the simplest of terms. This is not about some PhD. This isn't about some scientific formula that keeps us here. This is about doing things that of our own nature we would not do. Who would want to show up in a meeting of people that don't drink? You know, who would want to go have some girl sit next to you in your car, shaking, rattling, and rotting, coming off of the alcohol, and do something as simple as, here, eat this banana and drink this juice, whether you like it or not. And then all of a sudden see the shake sort of diminish, and she looks at you and says, wow, that really worked. What a concept. Where did I get that? That's what they did with me. It's as simple as that. And it works. I like it. It works. It really does. So this is Sunday morning, and this is August, and it is hotter than besiegeds outside. And we're going to go out from here, and we're going to get on with our lives, and we're going to try to be the best people we can. And what I'm hoping is that maybe a year from now, I'll see you here. Maybe a year from now, one of us will not have to die from this disease, and we can come back and share. And in the meantime, put your name on those 12-step lists at your local central office. Become willing to go on those 12-step calls and put up with those pain-in-the-ass newcomers that are sitting next to you because you're just too darn busy. That's me. And I want what we have. And I want to be able to give that to somebody else. And then maybe they'll stick around and want more of it. And, you know, this has been one heck of a weekend. There's been a lot of driving in my life the last 3 days, and it's been worth every bit of it. I love being in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love watching the changes that happen. I love seeing God's discoveries and God's gifts happen in other people's lives. And I'm blown away at what he's given me. I'm blown away at the fact that I get to stand up. I get to stand up here this evening and share with you stuff that I would never in a million years have shared with somebody out on the street for all the tea in China. But for here, it applies, and here it makes it possible for me to go out there and live. And once again, thank you, Paul, for having me here. I want to thank each and every one of you for being here and tolerating this last hour. And thanks for my recovery.